Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. One of the big questions for us to face as we look to the future is about the collision between Christianity and Islam, between Western civilization and Islam. Few people are as capable in speaking about this as George Weigel. He is the author of the new book, Faith, Reason, and the War Against Jihadism, A Call to Action. He'll be our guest in just a few moments, and it's going to be a fascinating conversation. Mr. Weigel writes with a clarity, a candor, an honesty, and I think a straightforwardness that is rare in books of this kind. And he also writes about Islam as a theological reality. That's what really sets his book apart. Many people looking at this just in historical, sociological, geopolitical terms. It's good to have someone who's looking at these things clear-eyed with a theological perspective as well. Theology matters. That in our conversation coming up in just a few moments. To join that conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, to review some other issues in the news, at my website at albertmohler.com. Overnight, I published an article entitled, A Rather Unexpected Aspect of IVF, that's in vitro fertilization. The news has come out of Britain that over 1 million human embryos have been destroyed over the last 12 years. The advent of IVF technology, by the way, the first test tube baby, then so-called, was born in Great Britain over 20 years ago. And the advent of that technology has brought many things. For one thing, it's led, at least in a sidewise trajectory, to the development of human embryonic stem cell research. But it's in the news because over 1 million human embryos have been destroyed in Great Britain. This is reported in the Times of London. The embryos were produced in order to lower the net cost of pregnancies and to ensure an adequate supply of embryos for potential transfer into a woman's womb. Given the fact that many IVF transfers do not lead to a successful pregnancy, the prevailing policy calls for the development of multiple embryos just in case. As the Times reports, what I'm reading here, the scale of the wastage, that's in so-called excess or surplus embryos, has sparked calls from politicians and infertility groups to find ways to avoid so many being created for treatment. An alternative suggestion is that it should be made easier for couples to adopt viable embryos unwanted by their natural parents so they have a chance at life. Reading on from the Times report, Lord Alton, the independent peer who obtained the figures after tabling a parliamentary question, said embryos are being destroyed, quote, at an incredible rate. This also from Lord Acton, and I quote, IVF has ensured that a number of people have been given a chance to have children, but it is surprising how many embryos are being destroyed in the process. This is a rather unexpected aspect of IVF. If you could just create an embryo to implant, that would be fine. I think it would be much better if these embryos that are going to be destroyed were used for infertile couples. At least they would have a chance of life. The number of embryos used is expanding year after year. End quote. Well, my response to that is, with all due respect to this member of Britain's House of Lords, how could this be an unexpected aspect of IVF? It couldn't possibly be unexpected. It just was hidden from view. I mean, after all, if you know ahead of time that the prevailing policy, the standard practice in vitro fertilization, is to create far more embryos than are ever going to be transferred to a woman's womb, you can't claim that the existence of those so-called surplus embryos is unexpected. I think the better word there might be unacknowledged. But it's acknowledged now when you have in the press a report that is demanded by this peer that reveals that over 1 million unborn human beings in embryonic form have been killed by destruction there in Great Britain. Now, in the United States, if anything, the numbers may be higher. Not yet totally destroyed, because in the United States we do not yet have a protocol that requires the destruction of frozen embryos after 10 years. The reality is those embryos are beginning to break down and all the rest, but what we have is an entire collection of humanity, well over 1 million surplus embryos in this country, that are in cold storage, literally in the deepest of cryogenic freezing. And this is an assault upon human dignity. And it really has piqued pierced the conscience there in Great Britain, where when you have a headline about 1 million human embryos being destroyed, all of a sudden people wake up. Now, I think the other moral inconsistency in this is the suggestion that the issue here is that we should lower the number of human embryos that would be surplus, excess, and eventually destroyed, as if it's a matter of the number. Folks, let's just remember that it's the moral status of the embryo that's important here. And if the moral status of the embryo is important, then the destruction of one or 1 million, both of those would be problematic. Both of those would be understood as the wanton destruction of human life. Both of those would be understood as being morally and medically indefensible. Now, one of my concerns is that there are an awful lot of evangelical Christians who make use of the IVF technology and celebrate the IVF technology without recognizing so much that generally goes with it. I've written much about this, participated in a book project about this a few years ago, and I just want us to remember that there are no medical technologies like this that do not come with moral risk. There are no medical technologies like this that do not come with hard decisions. And of all people, we better be the ones who are open-eyed and clear-headed about this, so that we're not in a position in which we claim, at least somewhat disingenuously, if perhaps out of naivete, that this was an unexpected aspect of IVF. It's not unexpected. If the standard procedure calls for it, it's not unexpected. There's a lot of stuff going on in the news that, well, catches the attention of people at different aspects of the culture. I'll admit that this is not something that's generally on my radar screen. I never expected that today I would be talking about a major cultural phenomenon having to do with Spider-Man, but here I am, as I'm listening to myself. Spidey is no longer married. In the continuation of the publication of the Spider-Man cartoon series, the comic book series, Spider-Man and Mary Jane are split. They are, quote, sacrificing their love to save the life of Spider-Man's dying aunt. The longtime couple does that by making a deal with the devil. It says here, wipes out all the record of their lives, and that includes marriage. Why in the world are we talking about this? It's because it is culturally significant. It turns out that Marvel Comic Books has decided that it just doesn't fit for Spider-Man to be married. That says something about where we are as a culture, having to do with the whole thing related to sex, young adulthood, and marriage. You see, in times past, it fit that a young man this age would be married. But in contemporary American culture, it just doesn't fit anymore to think that a young man of Spider-Man's age, potentially in the middle 20s, would be married. It just doesn't fit. People can't connect to it. Reading from the report in USA Today, it says that Craig Shutt, a columnist for Comics Buyer's Guide, says, quote, nobody wants to read about a married Spider-Man. Nobody. Well, that's very interesting. It tells us a great deal about where we are. It also explains why so many young adults aren't growing up to be adults. It explains why we have this extension of adolescence well into the 20s and perhaps even into the 30s. There's a report also coming out from Brigham Young University that a study done by three BYU professors has suggested that 80% of parents do not consider their 18 to 25-year-old college students to be adults. Now, that much I can understand. But this may surprise you. The students overwhelmingly agree with the parents. In other words, we have young adults, at least that's the way we almost have to describe them. 18 is the age of majority. They're legally described as adults, but they are not sociologically, relationally, intellectually, personally, individually adults. They're not functioning as adults. The time period for which parents are responsible for their children is lengthening, and parents now have expectations for their children once they reach their 20s. The study shows evidence that a distinct life stage has emerged between adolescence and adulthood. Larry Nelson, associate professor in the School of Family Life and lead author in the study, refers to students in this stage as, quote, emerging adults. Another interesting aspect here is revealed in the press report. It says here, when parents of college-age children have reached adulthood, only 16% of mothers and 19% of fathers said yes, that is, it's okay to still be considered a child rather than an adult. The study also showed evidence of disagreements among generations about what it takes to be considered an adult. Parents said their children needed to be responsible for things like driving, drugs, alcohol, sex, and language in order to be considered an adult. Now, I'd like to see more about that. And it'd be interesting to see if Brigham Young releases that entire report, but we are seeing this phenomenon all around us. While speaking about love, marriage, and generations, and all the rest, Newsweek magazine has a very, very interesting article, a column. It says in its title, Yes to Love, No to Marriage. We're going to be talking about this next week because this is an argument that is heard again and again now in this culture where people say, I want long-term commitment, not just to periodic cohabitation, but now not only in young adulthood, but in middle age, there are a lot of adults who are saying to their families, we're going to be together. We want you to treat us as a couple. We consider ourselves partners, but don't call us married. We're not going to have the marriage. We're not going to have the ceremony. We're not going to have the certificate. We're not going to have the legal recognition. Deal with it. We're getting the question from some people observing this saying, just what does all of this then mean? Do you have to have a wedding? Do you have to have a marriage? Do you have to have a certificate? Good questions for us. We'll return to that next week. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the conflict between Christianity and Islam and what this means for the future. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 877-8-GOLD-101.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Writing a book on Islam and the challenge presented to Western civilization by Islam is in itself a rather brave thing, and not only because of potential opposition from Muslims who may be offended by the book, but frankly from Western liberals, who will charge you with Islamophobia or intolerance for writing honestly about the phenomenon of Islam. And as a Christian theologian, I've run into this time and time and time again, even this week in certain conversations. One of the men in America I most admire for taking these issues on is George Weigel. He is Distinguished Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He's also a Catholic theologian and one of America's public intellectuals. George Weigel's the author of several books. I think I have them all and have read them all. Mr. Weigel, welcome to the Albert Mueller Program.
Nice to be with you.
Listen, I really do appreciate your new book, and just so listeners hear it, the title is Faith, Reason, and the War Against Jihadism. I want to read a paragraph from your book to you. It hardly surprised you, but it might be very clarifying for our radio audience. I'd like to have you respond to it.
Sure.
Mr. Weigel writes, how men and women think about God, or don't think about God, has a great deal to do with how they envision the just society and how they determine the appropriate means by which to build that society. This means taking theology seriously, which includes taking seriously others' concepts of God's nature and purposes and their commitments to the beliefs arising from these concepts, as well as the theologies that have shaped the civilization of the West. If we have not learned this over the past 5 years, one wonders if we have learned anything. Now, Mr. Weigel, I have to tell you, George, there are very few people that are honestly writing about this as a theological collision between Islam and the West and Islam and Christianity. Where did you come up with this?
Well, it has seemed to me to be this right from the beginning. I suppose the immediate impetus to my own thinking about this in these explicit terms was Pope Benedict XVI's Regensburg lecture in September 2006. But it had seemed to me since 9/11 that there was a bizarre reticence about describing the problem for what it is. I would describe it, frankly, as a war within the Islamic world over Islam's confrontation with modernity that has now spilled out to involve the rest of the world. So it's not only some Muslims against Christians, some Muslims against the secular West, Muslims against Jews. It's one gang of jihadists against their own Muslim brethren and the rest of the world.
Well, one of the things I think you do effectively in your book is demonstrate that jihadism is not necessarily an aberration. It makes sense within the Muslim worldview that separates the world between the world of Islam and the world of war, and that sees a cultural and indeed universal eschatological purpose for Islam in bringing the world under the Quranic rule.
Well, there are certainly core theological themes in Islamic self-understanding that given certain historical, social, economic circumstances can push a considerable part of the Islamic world in a very aggressive direction. The more immediate problem is this marriage, a marriage made in hell, between an astringent, extremist, aggressive, violent interpretation of what is required of Muslims. The marriage between that and a kind of postmodern nihilism, which lifts up and celebrates death, which lifts up and celebrates murder. And that's modern jihadism, which has its ideological roots 60 years ago in two Egyptian intellectuals whose work I discuss in the book, Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, and Saeed Qutb. And it's terribly important that we understand all of this, just as it was important that we understood the ideological configuration of communism during the Cold War. Because as with the confrontation with communism, this is, I think, fundamentally a war of ideas. It's a conflict between radically different visions of human goods, radically different visions of the human future. And in order to contest that war successfully, we have to understand the other side's ideas, and we have to be able to give an account of why our way of organizing society is morally superior.
Now, you take their ideas seriously, and that certainly has to be a primary intellectual responsibility of all of us right now. But if you're going to take their ideas seriously, one of the things you seriously consider is their idea of God. Why is the Muslim understanding of God more given to this kind of worldview than the biblical understanding of God in the Judeo-Christian tradition?
Well, it's interesting that in both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, there are lots of accounts of wrestling with God. Abraham bargains with God over the fate of Sodom and Gomorrah. David discusses with God whether he should build a temple or not. Moses is constantly arguing with God. The prophets of Israel are arguing with God, in some cases, about why are you doing this to me? In the New Testament, Jesus is in conflict with the religious authorities of his time. The biblical tradition, because it begins with the idea of a God of reason who imprints his reason on his creation, including us, is a view of monotheism in which God relates to us in a way that we can wrestle with him, in which there is genuine spiritual wrestling. The God of Islam, Allah, as Pope John Paul II said in Crossing the Threshold of Hope, is not Emmanuel. He is not God with us. He is majesty. He is glory. He is the lawgiver. But he is not God with us. He is remote and distant. And I think that's part of the difference that makes this trope of three Abrahamic religions much less useful than people think.
Well, not only much less useful, I have to say I don't think it's true, just theologically defined, given the Trinitarian shape of our Christian understanding. Let me ask you about two other specific aspects of Islam, and we'll have to continue this when we come back from this break. But
sure.
When we come back, I'd like to ask George Weigel to discuss how the idea of fatalism plays into this, and the understanding of the meaning of humanity, what we would call a theological anthropology, how the Muslim understanding of these things that is rooted in classical Islam might lead to something very different. Mr. Weigel in his book writes, for instance, about the fact that it's very difficult to have a conversation, a reasoned conversation, with people who are quite willing to kill themselves, to martyr themselves, in the service of Allah. That makes this rather impervious to reason. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. Some of you may have a question you want to address to George Weigel. Some of you may have read some of his books, maybe even already this new book. If not, you need to read it. We'll be discussing when we come back, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. There are some books just with the perfect title. One of those is the book, now classic, by Russell Kirk entitled Ideas Have not by Russell Kirk, excuse me, Richard Weaver, entitled Ideas Have Consequences, because they do. Ideas certainly have consequences, and our ideas about God and the meaning of humanity and the meaning of life and morality have ultimate consequences for our life. George Weigel is the author of the book Faith, Reason, and the War Against Jihadism. He is with the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He's with us today. Mr. Weigel, I want to go back to the question I posed to you before the break. What does this really have to do with the kind of understanding of fatalism that is at the very heart of the Muslim understanding of how Allah operates his creation?
I think the immediate problem we're dealing with in this inability of Islamic societies to date to come to grips with political modernity, with religious freedom, with the separation of religious and political authority in the state, goes back to the simple fact, the historical fact, that, as Bernard Lewis put it, Muhammad was his own Constantine. The Christian Church had almost 300 years to develop a sense of its own integrity, its own identity, before its legalization in the Constantinian settlement began a process of entanglement with state power. State power, political power, and religious authority were utterly enmeshed in Islam from the beginning. And one of the great questions on which the future of the world is going to turn is whether that is something from which a development of doctrine, if you will, can take place, or whether that is going to remain the case in Islam forever. Now, if the latter is true, then this is very, very problematic for the question of Islam and modern political institutions. That's the fight that's been going on within the Islamic world for the last 80 years or so. That argument has now spilled out to engage the rest of the world. And that's, as I say in the book, why questions of theology are driving history at this moment in time.
Well, let's take that one step further. You write appropriately about the impact of theological anthropology. How does that play out in this dynamic?
I think it has to do with this lack of wrestling we talked about before. A theological anthropology, an idea of the human person in which radical submission to God is the beginning of religious life, is the beginning of the life of faith. Submission to a God who gives very detailed instructions for the right construction of society. This doesn't quite get us to the notion that human beings, by the use of the moral reason that God built into us, as an expression of the fact that we are created in the image of a God of reason, and therefore can construct humane, decent, and just societies through the arts of moral reason. The theological anthropology of Islam tends to push towards this identification of Muhammad and Constantine, if you will, rather than to a proper separation of religious and political authority within well-defined spheres of influence.
Now, Mr. Weigel, let me ask you, as you look to the future, because I know our time is brief here, are you hopeful that there'll be some transformation within Islam, or do you see this as an ongoing civilizational conflict?
Well, I certainly think that this current struggle against jihadism, against these assertive, aggressive forces within the Islamic world, which are bent on the destruction of the West, could well go on for several generations. I also look to places like Indonesia, Bosnia, where there seems to be some different form of Islam emerging, with some hope.
Well, I would like to be able to share that hope, at least on the geopolitical stage, and we'll watch with open eyes. Our guest today has been George Weigel, the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and author of Faith, Reason, and the War on Jihadism. We'll be back with your calls in just a moment. Call us at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I'm Albert Moeller.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 877-8-GOLD-101.
Well, welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. I regret that Mr. Weigel was not able to stay with us to take your calls, but we are going to enter into conversation about these very significant ideas, the idea that at the collision of the war on terror, and certainly what we often refer to as the conflict between the West and jihadism, is a more basic conflict. And as a Christian theologian, I really do appreciate Mr. Weigel's approach to this, affirming that there is a theological dynamic behind this, and appropriately pointing to several specific things, including the differences between the way that Christians and Muslims understand God, human beings as made in the image of God, and thus the value and dignity of human persons. And I have to add more to that, though, as well, because I'm an evangelical Christian, and there are ways in which Mr. Weigel, who's a Roman Catholic, and I, as an evangelical, might have different ways even of understanding the collision between Islam and Christianity. And one of the things I appreciate is that he does make clear that the idea that we speak about three Abrahamic religions, supposedly Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the three Abrahamic religions, this he understands is unhelpful. And I have to come back and say it's not only unhelpful, it's just untrue. It's just profoundly untrue. Now, one of the issues that we really have to face here and look at the dynamic of what Islam is up to, and I don't just mean jihadism, but Islam, is that Islam is a supersessionist religion. Now, that may be one of the longer words to use on radio, so let me repeat it. Supersessionist. It means it supersedes. And so what we're really saying here is that Islam claims that it replaces Christianity and Islam, and Judaism, that it instead comes along and completes them. It's now something that is new. Not only is it new, but you do away with the old. You know, you don't need the Bible. You don't need the Old Testament. You don't need the New Testament. They replace the canonical New Testament understanding of Jesus, who he is, how he came to be, what he did. They replace all of that with their own version, which is not just slightly different. It's a different Jesus. It's a different Jesus who's not the Son of God, most importantly. And so I come back to the fact that if we're talking about a God whose son is not Jesus Christ, or as Islam puts it, a God who has no son, then you're talking about a different God. If you're talking about Jesus Christ, and you're talking about a Jesus Christ who isn't God incarnate, fully God and fully man, then you're talking about a different Jesus. And thus, the entire picture is radically different. And when you start looking at Islam, it not only sees itself as historically superseding Judaism and Christianity, it sees itself as having a world mission to bring the entire planet under Quranic rule. That is the rule of the Quran, their holy book. And they see this as their responsibility. Now, I want to unpack something that Mr. Weigel said that may need just a little bit of unpacking. When he was talking about Islam, he said one of the issues here is that Muhammad was his own Constantine. And there may be some people out there scratching heads saying, what in the world are you talking about? What he means by that is that there is no church in Islam. Instead, there's just the state. And it's because, and that's a reference to Emperor Constantine, who led the revolution whereby the Roman Empire was declared a Christian empire. He suggests, Mr. Weigel suggests, that one of the most crucial issues in understanding Islam and jihadism, the war on terror and all the rest, is understanding that it's all about the state. It's about compulsion. Now, there are some subtleties to this argument that I think are really important. Dimitude. That may be a word that you've never heard of. It sounds like attitude. It doesn't mean a dim attitude. Dimitude means you are allowed to be a Christian in an Islamic state. You are a second-class citizen. And eventually, if you want to have a normal life, if you want to be able to contribute to society, you have to convert. Now, one of the sad things of just reading the history of the last, say, 1,400 years is that dimitude has been the experience of many Christians who have lived in lands that have become conquered by Muslims. What Mr. Weigel writes about, and this I say with clarity and courage, he writes about the fact that in the West, many of us are buying into a voluntary dimitude. Even though there are no Muslim armies that have conquered England, as we talked about on this program, there are places in England, London, especially the northern cities of Great Britain, where you simply don't go if you're a Christian, because they've largely been taken over as Muslim enclaves. Dimitude is all you would be allowed. Dimitude is reflected in the fact that many of us just don't speak honestly about Islam. Even some who know better don't speak honestly about Islam because we're afraid we'll be charged with being Islamophobic or intolerant or something like that. And there are organizations such as CAIR in Washington, D.C., that advocate on behalf of Islam in the United States, such that if you say something, I think that's the Council for American Islamic Relations, the moment you say something critical of Islam, you're jumped on saying you just don't get it, that's a misconstrual, or all the rest. Ideas have consequences. Ideas do matter. Ideas about God, the meaning of humanity, the meaning of life, morality, these matter the most in terms of human existence. And it takes not only some intellectual effort to try to unpack all of that, it takes actually some reading, some literacy in a document like the Quran. And if you have any doubt about the internal dynamic of Islam and the teachings of Islam, all you have to do is read the Quran, and this will be made clear. You may have some questions about what certain texts mean and all the rest, but at least the great shift, the great change as measured between Christianity and Islam will become immediately apparent. Now, the issue of martyrdom factors into this because the Muslim understanding of history is fatalistic. It will happen. That comes from the Muslim expression, inshallah, if Allah wills. And, you know, one of the things cited in Mr. Weigel's book is the fact that the Muslim view of history allows persons to say, look, we must be in contest to bring the world under Islamic rule, even if that means in the minds of some people using extreme measures and even martyrdom, because we can't lose. We can't lose in the sense that either we win or we win by fatalistically yielding to the will of Allah. In any event, this is a very different understanding, and it does go back to the fact that we have a very different understanding of God. No Muslim would really speak of having a personal relationship with Allah. We have a very different understanding of Allah versus the God of the Bible. We as Christians refer to God as Father. That is not a name of God you will find in Islam. And we understand human beings are not just creatures, but creatures made in the image of God. That makes all the difference in the world. Back with more in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We'll be tracking the issue of Islam. And again, I would recommend that book to you. I think you'll find it very interesting. I want to recommend another book to you as we come to the conclusion of the program today. And that's the book entitled The Gospel and Personal Evangelism by my friend Dr. Mark Dever, pastor of Capitol Hill Baptist Church in Washington, D.C. I was really moved to write about this because just yesterday I heard from a pastor who told me that he had recently participated in an ordination council where the minister to be ordained said, just informed the committee that he had never, ever shared the gospel one-on-one with anyone. Now, I was shocked by that, but I was much more shocked to find out that the council went on and ordained this man. I mean, that's the amazing thing. But nonetheless, it does reveal the fact that an awful lot of Christians simply either do not know how to share their faith, or just do not share their faith. Few books, I think, can be as powerful in helping Christians to understand what it means to share the faith and to be involved in personal evangelism than Dr. Dever's book, The Gospel and Personal Evangelism. He really grounds evangelism in the gospel and God's passion to save sinners through faith in Christ. He argues that personal evangelism, and I love his word for it, should be normal for Christians. It should be normal, not a matter of special interest, not a matter of occasion, special emphasis. He writes this. He says, evangelism is not an imposition of our ideas upon others. It is not merely personal testimony. It is not merely social action. It may not involve apologetics, and it is not the same thing as the results of evangelism. Evangelism is telling the wonderful truth about God, the great news about Jesus Christ. When we understand this, then obedience to the call to evangelize can become certain and joyful. Understanding this increases evangelism as it moves from being a guilt-driven burden to a joyful privilege. There's a lot of joy in this book, a lot of first person. Dr. Dever has done us a great service in writing this book, and as you read it, you'll come to understand the gospel with greater clarity, and certainly also evangelism with greater clarity and security and understanding. He concludes the book by saying this, we do not fail in our evangelism if we faithfully tell the gospel to someone who is not subsequently converted. We fail only if we do not faithfully tell the gospel at all. As I wrote in my article and review about this morning, that failure is writ large across the church today. I hope that the gospel and personal evangelism, this new book by Dr. Mark Dever, can be a much needed corrective to all that. We're going to come back tomorrow and talk about something that may literally hit pretty close to home. Stephen Moore, writing in the Wall Street Journal, has two teenage sons, and he says that they have become teenage zombies to the point that he had to simply take away the video machine. He was watching what was happening to his own sons. That may sound rather extreme to you. We're going to be talking about the impact of video games and the real study coming out, research indicating what this means for young people in America. I'll meet you tomorrow. This is Albert Moeller.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.